Governor Eric Greitens called lawmakers back to Jefferson City again to debate legislation aimed at restricting abortion. And one of the things on the agenda is undoing a St. Louis ordinance protecting people against discrimination if they've had an abortion or take birth control. The sponsor of that measure, Alderman Megan Green, joins us on the next edition of Politically Speaking to break down the special session and what it will mean for St. Louis. So let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, a candid conversation with the Show Me State's biggest political newsmakers.
I'm Jason Mersenbaum.
And I'm Joe Manis.
That's Eric Greitens, Navy SEALs running for governor, and I'm really, really glad to be on with you, Jason and Joe.
I'm going to push back on these regulators.
I'm doing this for the people.
I was encouraged along the way, not just by my family, but by a lot of teachers and professors, and knew when I was in college that I would run for office someday.
We're very excited about the prospect of having some more free market solutions.
Even though after the conversation, I still might not agree.
We want our listeners to get a real sense of what drives these people.
They're actually people with a story to tell.
And welcome to the Politically Speaking podcast, the only podcast about Missouri politics that guarantees that you will succeed. I'm your host, Jason Rosenbaum, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Joining me in studio today is
colleague Joe Manis, and I have no idea what you're talking about.
That is actually a reference to a sign that is along Hampton Avenue at a vape store. And the other side of the sign says, why not vape? And it's a question I've never been able to answer.
I'm not a smoker, so.
Neither am I. And joining us for the second time, but the first time as an alderman, alderwoman, because the first time I think was like a week before you were sworn in, we have as our guest
Alderwoman Megan Green in St. Louis City, 15th Ward.
And before we pepper you with tough questions, just remind our listeners the boundaries of your ward and which neighborhoods it takes in.
So it's essentially Tower Grove South, from halfway through Tower Grove Park to Chippewa on the south side, and South Grand to Morgan Ford.
As I found out before the show, your ward is where I get my glasses. And I actually got these glasses a couple of weeks ago after my other ones broke. I strongly recommend Lucas Optometry. They are a great 15th Ward business.
We have a lot of wonderful businesses in the 15th Ward. We are very lucky.
So we brought you in today to talk about state politics a little bit, but also aldermanic politics later in the show. The reason why I mentioned state politics is right now in Jefferson City, the legislature is debating a multifaceted bill that restricts abortion in a number of different ways.
Yeah, now one thing to point out, this is we're getting into the home stretch of the second week of what is expected to be a three-week special session, and it costs the state, well, when both chambers are in, roughly close to $70,000 a week. So this particular special session will be particularly expensive, and the bottom line is the governor called it because there was a number of abortion-related bills, mainly to restrict or regulate the remaining abortion clinic in the state, and they did not get through the regular session for various reasons. And then a couple weeks ago, the governor announced that he had been under some pressure from some legislators who were upset that the stuff had not gotten through the regular session and wanted to bring it up again, in part because of two things. A federal judge ruled the end of April, beginning of May, that the U.S. Supreme Court decision that affected the Texas regulations also affected Missouri. And so Missouri had a number of regulations that had been in place, in fact, in some cases 10 years, that were tossed out. So the General Assembly wanted to act in response to that, at least the abortion opponents wanted to act to that. The other reason, and one of the reasons you're here, is because the city of St. Louis passed a provision to its anti-discrimination ordinance that added women who've had abortions, women who are birth control. Did it also include pregnant women?
Includes pregnancy, miscarriage, using IVF, abortion, and contraception.
Okay, so basically almost any reproductive aspect of a woman's life.
Yes.
And that was added to the anti-discrimination measure that the city has, and basically it prevents landlords or employers from discriminating against any of the women in these particular classes. Some legislators contend that, A, it's overreach, that it's not in line with state law, B, there are also some legislators and the governor who contend that this is an attack on pregnancy resource centers, which are basically centers that are supported by abortion opponents. They get some state money and counsel women against having abortions and try to offer alternatives. So I'm just putting this in, kind of laying this out so our listeners know as we go forward. And Making Green was one of the key sponsors of the city ordinance in question.
So I want to start off, what was the impetus behind this ordinance? Did you have a lot of instances where people were discriminated against for their employment or their housing because of their reproductive choices?
So it was a couple of things. First off, I think it's important to note that St. Louis wasn't the first city that has done this. So Boston and D.C. and the state of Delaware all did this before we went down this path.
Now, some question, well, when I was checking into Boston, it's unclear if Boston's done it or if they're talking about doing it.
Boston's passed.
Okay. And second, the opponents say that St. Louis's is actually more expansive. I'm just passing that on.
I know. There's a lot of misinformation out there about what we did, because we actually, you know, modeled it after what was done in Boston and in D.C. Very similar language. So we ended up the third city in the country that did this. One of the main reasons to decide to do this was because of something called the Russell Amendment. It was an amendment that was tacked on to a defense spending bill at the federal level. And basically that amendment allowed defense contractors to not hire someone because they were using birth control, they had an abortion, they were in a same-sex marriage, they had a child out of wedlock. It had this whole laundry list of things. That amendment did not pass this time around. But what we often see is when something comes up like that, then an organization like ALEC will take that and start to introduce model legislation across the country to say, hey, now it's okay to discriminate on the basis of using birth control. And when we've already seen, you know, the Supreme Court decide in the Hobby Lobby case that employers don't have to cover birth control if it's against their religiously held belief, you know, we feel like this is the next step. And then the second piece of it, until you actually have something a part of your non-discrimination ordinance, you have no idea how prevalent anything is, because then we don't track it as a city. So what this is doing is saying, you know, we think that this is important enough that women have private rights to determine what they do with their own body, that regardless of, you know, what their employer or their landlord says, that they need to have that individual freedom. And so this allows us to be able to track should that not be
now,
the case.
Now, had you been hearing reports of cases of discrimination? Is this reactive or preventative is basically what I'm getting
at. It's mostly preventative, although I will say that since this passed, we've had several folks that have come forward and said, yes, this has happened to me. The most egregious one who's been working with NARAL is a case of a woman who had a miscarriage and ended up getting fired from her employment because of dealing with all of the medical complications from it and then some of the psychological impacts of it, and was missing work and ended up getting fired as a result.
Now, I have read the bill that is still in legislative transit right now, and I've read it pretty carefully. And what I have been hearing from people is that the bill essentially voids the ordinance. But from reading the text, the only thing that I saw is that it exempts pregnancy resource centers and says that a landlord can't be forced to essentially, you know, a landlord can't be forced to rent to an abortion clinic or something along that lines. It did not appear to me that it voids the entire ordinance.
Well, some of this is the product of some late night negotiations in the state Senate side. The original bill was much broader.
Yeah.
But during these late night sessions, because they were trying to avoid a Senate filibuster by the Democrat minority. So that's sort of the setup here. Alderwoman Green, what's your take on what the bill says now?
I mean, my take is exactly like Jason was saying. It doesn't seem to have a whole lot of impact on what we passed here at the local level. They're basically seeking to further deregulate crisis pregnancy centers, which already have very, very lax regulations around them. The portion about not requiring a landlord to rent to an abortion clinic, that is already exempt in the bill that we passed at the local level. And there's already religious exemptions in there, and a lot of these crisis pregnancy centers that are religiously affiliated would already be exempt under our local ordinance.
So is it your belief that this bill doesn't actually affect your ordinance very much?
Correct. I think that we are spending $20,000 a day basically to do nothing to our local ordinance. What it is doing is allowing a bully pulpit for the governor to basically say that he's doing something when in fact what they're pushing does very little.
Now, the archdiocese was pretty vocal. I mean, you know, the archbishop came out to blast the provision shortly after it went into effect. If it exempts religious organizations, why was the archdiocese so vocal against it?
You know, what's interesting is the exemption language that we included in the bill was given to us by the archdiocese. And we put their exact language in the bill. There was one sentence that we did not include, which would have made the entire ordinance contingent upon state law, which obviously we weren't going to do.
Because that will never happen.
But all of the religious exemptions that are in there were given to us by the archdiocese. I think that at the end of the day, the archdiocese is going to be opposed to anything that has to do with women's health. And we need to just take that at face value and know that no matter what we put in that bill, because it had the word abortion in it, they were never going to be on board.
So I'm going to play a clip now from Governor Eric Greitens before the special session occurred. And he was asked about the question of local control, because in the past couple of sessions, the legislature has taken it upon itself to basically try to invalidate things that St. Louis or St. Louis County has done. This was his response to that question.
Look, I think that we absolutely need to be supporting people all over the state of Missouri. I want to support local control, but when we have radical politicians who want to do things like attack the work of a wonderful organization like Our Lady's Inn that is helping pregnant women, helping them and their newborn children, we have to stand up and defend them. We have to stand up and support them so that these organizations, which have been driven into court by these radical activists, they know that we're going to support them and we're going to have their back.
So I think that he was referring to people like you. First of all, is that flattering that you're called a radical politician
radical activist?
Does that make you sad?
I don't think that standing up for women's autonomy is radical. And I think that if we, I think it's very scary that we have a governor that thinks that advocating for women and for women's health and their ability to make their own decisions is radical. That should not be radical. Are we in The Handmaid's Tale? I mean, this is a little ridiculous here.
Well, I do want to touch on his point, the whole aspect of local control, because I think that a lot of St. Louis area lawmakers have become very agitated when the legislature, you know, tries to repeal your ordinance or tries to strike down the minimum wage law, which appears to have happened. A lot of proponents of those will say, you know, it's good to have uniform regulations across the state. You know, they would probably argue in this instance that if you look at the composition of the Missouri General Assembly, it's very much filled with people who oppose abortion rights, and that is the will of the statewide voice, so to speak. What's kind of your take on this? Because I'm sure that you're not pleased that the legislature is taking this tack, but it seems to have become a trend.
I think they're doing it because we're winning. And not just in St. Louis, but in cities all across the country. The preemption is, you know, the new ALEC tactic.
Now, just so our listeners know, when you refer to ALEC, you're referring to an organization that the full name is the American Legislative Exchange Council.
Correct.
It's basically a conservative group. They come up with proposed changes to state or local laws. They focus mainly on state and local statutes and laws.
And they basically give model policies, you know, to states to introduce. And we've had cases in Missouri where the state name isn't even changed on the bill because they've just borrowed it from Ohio and given it to Missouri and said, you know, put this in there. Mm-hmm. But basically, you know, we see groups like ALEC who who are afraid of the progressive policies, the pro-worker policies, the pro-women policies, the pro-immigrant policies that are coming out of our cities right now. And so they have to figure out a tactic to stop that, because what happens, what we know is cities are incubators. And we're the first place that policy gets tested out before it expands statewide and nationally. And we've seen that with the fight for 15. I mean, 5 years ago, nobody thought that any, you know, place would have a $15 minimum wage. And now we have a number of cities across the country. And that fights their entire narrative, and it fights, you know, their corporate backers who don't want to see higher wages paid, who don't want to see more employee benefits, that want to be able to have, you know, terminate somebody under discriminatory means if they so choose. And so we have, you know, I think we have a responsibility as cities to stand up and say, no, we cannot allow them to impose their views on us. And so, you know, we have to continue to fight these battles at the local level.
Now, I did this story on local control about a week ago. And one of the key messages from the legislators I talked to, aside from what Jason was saying, if they think there needs to be uniform standard, is that they feel that it just makes, they say that it hurts the state's economy because many of the economic growth is often in urban or suburban areas. I mean, how do you respond to that? Because this is the same line you're hearing in some other states as well. So, I mean, how do you respond to that?
I mean, I think what we see is discrimination hurts economic growth. You know, the number of folks that I, you know, come across in St. Louis City who will say, you know, I've stayed here for 5 or 6 years. I really like it here, but the state is just so backwards. It's not accepting. I'm moving out to the coast. You know, people want to live in a place where they feel safe, they feel protected, they feel included. And when our state government is continually passing laws to marginalize people who are immigrants, people who are minorities, people who are women, that makes it a lot harder for us to sell that Missouri is a place where people should choose to locate.
Now, and I make this point often, and I don't mean to sound like a broken record, but one of the things the legislature also preempted that Democrats supported was killing St. Louis's ordinance in 2013 on a foreclosure mediation. And some feel that Democrats got behind that in the legislature because banks and real estate entities are very powerful. And there was not a lot of outcry locally. There was some outcry locally, but not nearly to the effect based off this minimum wage situation and this abortion situation. I just want to bring that in for context. That was before your time, right. So I'm not asking you to opine on that.
And some could argue, without getting in too much in the weeds, mm-hmm. that in the case of the mediation stuff, and I'm not, but is that some of it had not gone into effect yet. So in some cases, the public may not have been aware of what they were losing or gaining.
Yeah, I agree with that. But it
was
still
legislative action.
It was definitely upending local control, and Democrats
Correct.
Supported it.
Right. And I think that, you know, if we look at the long game here, I think that the Republicans' willingness to disregard local control is going to be their Achilles heel. Because when they've traditionally been the party of local control and always fighting against this big bad federal government overreach, but then suddenly they're doing that to local municipalities, I think we're going to get to a point where that does not sit well with people in rural areas. And it's certainly not sitting well with a lot of folks in the urban areas right now.
Now, do you see that any of this is related, fair or unfair, to what's going on in Washington, where there seems to be somewhat of a cultural debate? I mean, President Donald Trump, his support was not in the cities. His support was in the rural parts of the country and some suburbs. But the point being that when you look at where his core is, for him and for the Republican Party, it's increasingly rural with some suburban blocks. So does that contribute to what's going on here in Missouri, do you think, or not?
I think it does, and I think it's more extreme here in Missouri since, you know, our governor seems to be a very close friend of Trump. You know, even he called this special session, and he wasn't even there for it. He was hobnobbing with President Trump out in D.C. rather than, you know, coming and aligning the troops in Jefferson City. And so, you know, we have to really ask where our governor's allegiances are. They seem to be more in D.C. than they do in the state of Missouri right now.
That's actually a great segue into a similar topic, but a slightly different direction. As I'm sure that you know, because I think that you retweeted the article, I wrote an article on Sunday talking about whether the state Democratic Party should be accommodating to local candidates, especially in rural state legislative districts who oppose abortion rights. Now, I want to be clear. I don't think the state party can, you know, smite these candidates down and say they can't run. But given Amendment 2, where parties play a much bigger role in supporting legislative candidates, they could certainly decide, no, we're not going to spend $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 if you hold this position, especially since resources are going to be finite and they have to target certain areas strategically. So I'm actually going to play a clip now from Chad Perkins. He's a Republican. He's from Bowling Green. And I asked him if socially conservative candidates on the Democratic side would fare well in places like Northeast Missouri or otherwise.
It's true that I think that local Democrats and the local Democrat Party probably need to find their own place within the party or run the risk of saying, you know what, locally we have trouble winning, even when we have great and strong candidates, because the nationwide party just doesn't represent the views of the people which we try to represent.
So that point I actually may actually correspond with your thought process, in that if Democrats run candidates who are a lot like Republicans when it comes to social issues, voters will just vote for the Republicans because it just doesn't seem sincere on the Democratic side. Whereas we have seen instances like Claire McCaskill or Mel Carnahan or Jay Nixon, who have done very well in rural areas, supportive of abortion rights, and maybe voters there disagreed with them, but at least respected that they weren't trying to pander. I'd be interested to hear your view on this, because you are heavily involved in the state party. You're involved in the platform committee. You're a DNC committee woman. And I know that this debate has also risen to the national level.
I mean, I think Monday morning quarterbacking, you know, off of the November election, a lot of the feedback that Democrats got is that we didn't stand for anything. And I think that voters respect you more when they know what you stand for. Even if they don't agree with it, at least they trust you because you've been forthright enough to say, you know, yes, I believe in abortion rights. And you might not agree with me. These are my reasons. They might be different, you know, than your reasons. But we can agree to disagree on this. I think that it's dangerous when we start to pander as a party and move farther and farther to the right, to the point where it's unclear what it means to be a Democrat.
Now, some actually have said that probably the thing that may have hurt, I mean, forgetting, you know, the FBI and Comey and all that, is that there was a perception that Democrats weren't campaigning that hard in rural parts of the state or rural parts of the country. And that many were assuming that they don't have to win a majority. They just need to win enough votes in that part, in those parts of the country. And the perception was there were still a lot of retired labor workers and others who would still vote Democratic. Well, many of those people, I mean, I'm from rural Indiana originally, and I've looked at some of the county numbers, and the flipping between 2008, when Barack Obama was on the ballot, and 2016 was huge. I mean, there was a lot of people who voted for Barack Obama in the rural parts of Indiana that I grew up in who ended up voting for Donald Trump, not for Hillary. And one of the contentions was that she didn't talk enough about economic issues. And the reason I mention that is because that was the same complaint on the state level, even though former Missouri Attorney General Chris Koster, who was the Democratic nominee for governor, spent a lot of time courting rural agricultural groups, did a lot of campaigning on that. He and Jason Kander, who's running for the U.S. Senate, were on a bus going around the state. But there was still that narrative, even if it was unfair, that was still driven. So as someone in your position who's in Democratic leadership, how do you counter that? How do you make sure that people hear your economic message? And because some say that that's actually what was the, it was less the social issue debate than the lack of someone countering the promises that now President Donald Trump was making.
So I think it's a combination of things. I think first, Democrats didn't come to play. And in November, we did not field Democratic candidates in 2/3 of state rep districts.
Why?
And lack of candidate recruitment, lack of organization amongst the state party. And since then, we've changed a lot. We have our committees filled for the first time in 5 or 6 years, where we actually have, you know, a group such as myself traveling the state to listen to folks. What are their concerns? What does our platform need to look like? Actually talking to voters between elections, not just showing up, you know, a couple months in advance and saying, hey, vote for me and donate. We're actually out here doing the groundwork in the interim, and that's something that hasn't been done. I think in terms of the economic message, I think you hit the nail on the head. We haven't given an alternative to the Republican Party. We haven't said, you know what, healthcare isn't working as well as we would like it to under the Affordable Care Act. But the way that we need to strengthen it is by going to a single payer system, not by repealing it. We haven't been forthright in and even, you know, owning abortion issues, because abortion issues at their core are very economic issues. Most women who choose to have an abortion or to use contraception are doing so because of economic issues. Not being able to afford a family, being able to have time off work, when we don't have, you know, universal paid family leave, all of these things that make it very difficult to have a child. And so, you know, as a Democratic Party, I think we have to get more comfortable talking about these things and saying that, you know, at the end of the day, if you want to be, you know, a pro-life party, like the Republicans purport to be, then you have to support folks when they do choose to have a child. You do have to support them economically with living wages and good health care and basic human rights that that the Democrats are good on. We just fail to own it.
So going back to my original question, if we have a scenario in a year and a half or so where some of these rural districts do have Democratic candidates, but a lot of them do not support abortion rights, what do you think the party should do about it? Do you think that they should be, you know, funded like any other candidate? Do you think that they should get the organizational support that somebody who supports abortion rights gets? Or should they be treated differently? Because I ask this question because, you know, there's a long way to go before the Democrats even come close to taking back the Missouri legislature. But if they winnow down the numbers by adding people that don't support abortion rights, bills like they're being talked about in the special session are going to pass by the same margins, essentially. Mm-hmm. So I would be interested to hear what you think the Democratic Party as a whole should do if that happens, because as I mentioned on the outset, they have a lot more money to spend on candidates. And
right.
I'd be interested to hear
your take on it. I think that we have to not be hypocritical as a party. And what that means is if we are really going to own our kind of economic populism, then that means supporting abortion rights, because like I said, it's, you know, it boils down to a very economic issue for a lot of women. And I think it has to be a part of our party platform. I think you raise a very good point. If, you know, what is the point of just getting, you know, Democrats elected if they're not going to, you know, sway the vote on some of these harmful anti-woman laws? To me, then we might as well just elect Republicans. Just like, why would we, you know, elect a Democrat that's not good on labor issues? We wouldn't. Mm-hmm. And so we're not having that conversation about labor issues, but for some reason we are about women. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, if we really are going to be a party that, you know, is standing for equality, then we've got to own these issues and not be afraid of it.
Now, do you see, as said, because in the rural parts of the state, just using that as an example, where there does, so you're basically saying it should be a litmus test, A, and B, is there support out there? I mean, there were some who would say that the younger voters, Republican or Democrat, tend to be more libertarian when it comes to social issues. You know, Trump used to be. So, I mean, the point being that was not their key thing. So, do you think that that's going to help the Democrats in rural Missouri, or is it going to be, I mean, as Jason points out, where some are going to say, well, we don't care what they say, on the economic issues, because if they're not with us on abortion or gun rights, we just can't support them.
I think most people aren't single issue voters. I think that there's a small contingency that is, but I think that most people look at, you know, the totality of what somebody stands for. And I don't think that one issue is going to make or break a lot of folks. We also have to recognize that there are some voters we're just not going to get, and we have to be okay with that. But what we need to be doing as a party is expanding the electorate. You know, the biggest group of people in this last election were people who didn't vote. And so that gives us a lot of folks to connect with, to talk to educate about the issues and get on our side, rather than always thinking that it's a battle between stealing Republican votes over to the Democratic side.
So I want to hone in the conversation in the last few minutes a little bit more locally. The St. Louis Board of Aldermen has undergone a pretty big change. I think about there are 6 new members now. There'll be another new member after the July special election in the 20th.
So that's almost a quarter. So,
and there's a new mayor who's a former colleague of yours. I'm interested to hear kind of your feeling about the newly composed Board of Aldermen, at how it's interacting with the mayor, because, and I said this on a previous show, I know that there are factions on the Board of Aldermen. I don't necessarily like to say you're part of the progressive faction, because I don't think that people that aren't in that are conservative or whatnot, though that's typically what it's called. I think we should probably have a contest to name the different factions. Like the, I suggested that yours could be like the super awesome faction, and your the other one could be the super awesome one. I'm being a little facetious, but my point is, what's kind of your feeling on how the Board of Aldermen is after the election cycle?
I think it's really exciting. I think we have a lot of new blood who's really interested in working on policy and interested in working on issues and not necessarily beholden to all of the old ways of doing things, you know, particularly aldermanic courtesy. I think that's something that has held this city back when we're unwilling to challenge a development project or tax incentive that's occurring in somebody else's ward, even though it has citywide implications. And so I think it's really exciting seeing so many new, really policy-focused people joining the board. And they're also very, you know, equity-focused. You know, whether it's somebody who was elected on the north side or the south side, all of the new guard seems to be very committed to, you know, racial justice issues, to economic justice issues, to simple ideas of fairness. And I think that's really exciting.
I brought this up before the show, but my alderman, Tom Oldenburg, of the 16th Ward, and I mentioned the 16th Ward almost on a daily basis on this show, you know, the 16th Ward has probably more Republicans in it than any other ward, maybe the 12th Ward. And it does lean more conservative. And I would not say that Alderman Oldenburg is a liberal or, you know, left of center person. But he has been put on committees that deal with neighborhood development, that deal with housing and urban development. And I think that he is very much willing to work with other aldermen to make sure other development in other parts of the city goes well. And I think that's kind of an example of the collaborative nature that I'm seeing. And as a City of St. Louis resident who's seen, like, just factional wars and political squabbles, I think that's a positive sign. But do you think that some of the battling and acrimony that is sometimes known at the Board of Aldermen will eventually return despite the air of good feeling right now?
I mean, I think that there's still going to be a bit of a battle between, you know, what is the role of an alderman? You know, are we a legislative policymaking branch? Are we constituent service focused? What is it that our role is? And I think that we're seeing a lot of the new folks that are being elected are saying, you know what, we have not been a real policy making legislative body for a long time. And that has held us back in a lot of ways. And so I think that there's still going to be a little bit of, you know, contention among us until we figure out really what is the role and what do people in the city expect from us as a legislative body now. But I think it's a very exciting time.
Now, do you think some of this may be affected? I mean, by the soon change within a few years, where the Board of Aldermen will be reduced in size, does that sort of affect some of the dynamics?
I mean, it definitely could. It'll be interesting to see, number one, if that actually goes through. I have a feeling that there will be quite a few lawsuits around it. Personally, I would like to see a citizen-led commission draw the lines. I do not think it should be a political process, and I have a lot of concerns about the board or the mayor's office being involved in the drawing of those lines. And I would think that the more that we can put that process in the hands of the community, the better that process will go.
What's kind of your impressions of the mayor so far? I know you didn't support her. You were a big Tashara Jones fan. But I think that some of her early moves, well, I don't think that they have completely been popular among supporters of Treasurer Jones. Some of them have been, like when Chief Dotson was gone in 24 hours. I think a lot of people that did not support Lyda Crewson were very pleased about that. Mm-hmm. With that as a backdrop, what's kind of your impressions of her first few weeks in office?
I mean, I think she's definitely making some good moves in terms of hires. You know, bringing on Nicole Hudson, I think was a great, great addition. She had been with Forward Through Ferguson. So, you know, ensuring that we are putting racial equity at the front in our decision making. I think as much as I was sad to see him go, taking our legal counsel from the board, Tim O'Connell, who is also an extremely, you know, bright, forward thinking man, I think that all bodes really well. I think at the part of, you know, if you're looking at the police chief, though, yes, a lot of folks wanted Dotson out. I think there's a lot of concern that his replacement, the interim chief, isn't much better. And when he came out wanting to equip police officers with assault rifles, that definitely did not go over well with a lot of folks in the activist community in particular. And so I still think that, you know, the hardest thing to overcome really is, you know, the crime issue. And what we're seeing still from Mayor Crewson is, you know, more police, more cameras. And I think that that's a very outdated point of view for how we need to address our public safety issues in the city. And I imagine that until that discussion plays out and we really figure out what holistic public safety means for us as a community, there's still going to be a lot of challenges for the new mayor in getting buy-in.
Without getting too much in the weeds, but is there a detail or two about how you would approach public safety that you think would be better than what she's proposed so far?
So I think you have to look at our budget. I mean, right now we spend 53% of our budget on public safety and 3% on health and human services and expect to have good outcomes. We have a heroin epidemic in the city that we basically are putting no resources toward. And we know that the heroin trade drives a lot of our crime, whether it be property crime of people who are addicts who are trying to steal something so that they can sell it and get their next fix, or whether, you know, it's gang activity that is funded through a lot of the drug trade. We need to get innovative with how we, you know, address that and actually look at some of the root causes rather than always doing this reactionary policing model.
I know that the Board of Aldermen will be considering raising certain types of taxes to deal with the police pay issue, because St. Louis County passed a sales tax that will add more officers and raise salaries. And I can kind of understand the pushback among many in the activist community against hiring more police officers or spending a lot more money on pay. But kind of conversely, I could also see a danger of a lot of people leaving for St. Louis County, many of which have established very close relationships with neighborhoods, and then kind of replacing them with people that don't have those ties. So with that as a backdrop, do you think that there can actually maybe be some consensus on the pay issue, given that it kind of also affects the whole relationship building aspect
right,
that a lot of people on the progressive activist-y side want to do?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to, I guess, correct you on one thing.
Sure.
I don't hear a lot of backlash from the activist community about increasing salaries.
Okay.
I mean, people who are involved in the activist community are also part of the Fight for 15. Mm. They're, you know, they're fighting for living wages.
And that's why I was asking, and to make sure to clarify, but continue.
You know, they understand that we need to pay people well if we want good quality employees. I don't think anybody is pushing back on that. I think where we get pushback is on the need for more officers. We have the third most police per capita of any city in this country, behind only New York and D.C. If you put the white shirts into it, we are number six in the country. So we still have very high staffing levels. I think what that shows us is that our strategy is not effective. And you reach a point of diminishing returns if you just continue to add more police without a real effective strategy for dealing with our crime issues. I think where we're going to get the pushback is the fact that it's a sales tax, and we just raised sales taxes. And I think that folks are feeling very burdened by the taxation in the city right now. And as much as we want to pay officers more, I think we need to find a funding mechanism that does not disproportionately impact the poor.
Now, you know, there had been talk at some point of making it a property tax. I mean, this was early on, although things have changed. But now one of Crewson's arguments has been, this was during the campaign even, and you know this is just for our listeners, was that she was contending that because a lot of police are working huge amounts of overtime because there's just not enough for the various staffing that the city requires. So regardless of how the city ranks with other cities, I mean, her contention is, yeah, but we need X number for this and that and the other. And what we're doing is having a bunch of guys that are working and women working 12, 18-hour days, I mean, on a regular basis, with little time off, so they're working 6 and 7 days a week. How would you counter that if you don't add more police?
I think we need to look at what police are doing right now. I mean, we have a contingency of police that are constantly, you know, dealing with the homeless issue downtown. I don't think the job of police officers should be following around the homeless population. That is not a public safety issue. And I think that those resources could be put, you know, somewhere else much better. I think we also need to look at bringing non-traditional people into the police department. Tashara Jones talked a lot about social workers. I know a lot of the officers in my district are being asked to do things that police officers should not do, whether it's handling, you know, neighbor disputes about parking or trash being dumped in different areas. I mean, there, or even people with mental health issues that that their neighbors don't know how to deal with and are calling the police on them. We're asking them to do things that are not a part of their job. And so what we need to be doing is, instead of adding more police, is figuring out what are the skill sets that we need to bring in to really address those issues. And I think social workers is a big part of that.
Before we end the show, I would be remiss not to ask this question. Since you came on the show last time, you won two elections.
Three
elections against what I would consider pretty well-funded, strong candidates. Has there ever been an alderman in recent memory who's had to run as many times in such a short amount of time as you, by the way?
I have not, come across another person who has. I definitely have to say, you know, I've gotten very good at running for office.
Well, that was going to be my question, because I've heard your name circulated as somebody who might run for St. Louis Board of Aldermen president in a couple of years. I know it's 2017, 2019 is a eternity away. I wanted you, if you want to on this show, address whether you're going to officially announce that you're throwing your hat in the ring to that.
I mean, it's something that I am strongly considering. I think a lot of folks know that. I have not made an official decision. I think what's clear is that we need a different type of leadership at the Board of Aldermen. And whether that's me or that's somebody else, I haven't decided.
Well, now, have you talked to State Senator Jamila Nasheed, who also has officially put her name out?
Yeah, she definitely called me right when she was going to announce, asking if I was planning on running. I gave her the same answer that, you know, I haven't made a decision, but I think that we need change. The president of the board actually has more power than the mayor in this city, and what we haven't seen is a strong legislative agenda coming from the president. What we've seen is basically the board acting as the proxy for the mayor's office and doing whatever the mayor wants, rather than coming forth with a real, you know, forward-thinking agenda. And I think we need somebody in that leadership position that really has that forward-thinking view.
I just want to say that I've asked the "Are you running for X office?" question about 50 times on this show. Yours is probably the most honest and direct answer that I've gotten so far. So congratulations.
Well, I try to be honest and direct.
On that note, for all of our stories, stlpublicradio.org. Follow me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. Follow Joe on Twitter at
Jay Manis. That's J-M-A-N-N-I-E-S.
And how would people follow you on Twitter or any other parts of the World Wide Web?
On Twitter, it is at Megan Aaliyah, which is M-E-G-A-N-E-L-L-Y-I-A.
We'll be back next time. Until then, so long.